Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. This program is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. I'm Jane Wales, your host. Facebook's recent announcement that it would be launching a blockchain cryptocurrency has provoked a message of caution from regulators and central bankers around the world. Many worry that the social media's giant 2 billion strong user base could allow it to upend the current global banking system. Others embrace the technology's capacity to give financial system access to the billions who are now excluded. The currency, called Libra, could effectively become the world's first sovereign currency without a government to back it. Joining us for a conversation about this innovation is Angela Walsh, research fellow at the Center for Blockchain Technologies at University College London, and Nathaniel Popper, finance and technology writer for the New York Times. Moderating the program is my co-host, Ray Suarez. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, TPG, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. And now to Ray Suarez.
Welcome to you both. Great to have you along. I guess the best place to start with this particular topic is to help people understand what's at the core of this conversation. Nathaniel, what is a digital currency?
That's a great question and less easy to answer than you'd think. In a sense, a digital currency is just something like a PayPal dollar, you know, a dollar you have in a digital wallet that doesn't have any physical form and that you can send to other digital wallets. And so that's the traditional notion. And in fact, most money to some extent is already digital. You know, most dollars do not exist in any physical form. They're just a notation on some digital spreadsheet or ledger somewhere. But what we've gotten in recent years with the advent of Bitcoin is a new concept, a new kind of digital money. And this is a digital money that isn't just tracked by one company like PayPal or like by your bank, but this is a kind of digital money that exists almost independent of any institution. And so that was the big idea with Bitcoin, was that it was a kind of digital money that was tracked on this spreadsheet that was kept by a whole bunch of people, a whole network, so that there was no one institution that everybody was depending on. You had this money that was kind of free-floating. The original idea was that it was like a $20 bill, that you could hold that $20 bill without relying on any bank or anybody else. It was yours. And that's the idea with Bitcoin. And that idea that Bitcoin introduced has now taken on a whole bunch of new forms, the latest of which is the most prominent now is this idea that Facebook has introduced, that they're going to have their own digital money that, once again, is not just kept by Facebook, but by a whole group of institutions.
Well, the Facebook announcement caused a tremor in this world, Angela Walsh. How is Libra, which takes its name from an old Roman term for currency, how is it different from PayPal, from Bitcoin, from all the other things that have been proposed so far?
Nathaniel was talking about who is behind these digital monies. And there's kind of been this trend to kind of a fight about who gets to create money, who gets to operate money. And governments, right, for a very long time were the operators of what money is, how decisions are made about money. And with the cryptocurrency trend, the introduction of Bitcoin around 10 years ago, right, that expanded to just normal people. And what Facebook is bringing to the table here is saying, well, okay, maybe we've seen with cryptocurrencies that money doesn't just need to come from the government. It can come from other places. So maybe we will get in on this too. And it's very interesting because Facebook is very much an institution, just like governments are, right? So it's distinguished in my mind from cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and others by the involvement of large institutions. And so it's another big player, I think, stepping up and claiming control over the right to say what money is and who runs it.
Well, we'll talk more about Facebook's more than two dozen partners in a little while. Nathaniel Popper, when I want to buy something, if I wanted to use Libra, it still has to start with a euro, with a pound, with a dollar somewhere in the world. I mean, it originates with an actual piece of specie of value that somebody has in a bank, in their pocket. It's not just conjured into being, is it?
That's one of the pieces of Libra that Facebook designed to distinguish it from Bitcoin. So Bitcoin, is a mark on a digital ledger that is backed up really by nothing other than this network. What's happened to Bitcoin because of that structure is that the price of Bitcoin has shot up and down, and that's probably what most people are aware of with Bitcoin. You know, it goes from $100 to $20,000 for a Bitcoin because it's really hard to know what it should be worth. Facebook has said there's something valuable about the way Bitcoin operates, the way it can move around, but this volatility is not something we want. And so Facebook has introduced this design that its digital currency, which to some degree it's going to summon into existence out of nowhere, but it's only going to summon a Libra into existence when somebody puts a dollar into a bank account or a euro into a bank account. And so the idea with Libra is to give it a stable value. So you know it's backed up by X number of dollars, X number of euros. And Facebook has done something a little interesting here, which is to say, we're not just going to give Libra a value in dollars. We're actually going to back Libra up by a basket of currencies. So the Libra will be worth some amount, some combination of dollars, euros, yen, and that will give it this sort of international flavor. I think that's the idea. And the idea here is that it's not just pegged to $1. It's not just a digital dollar. It is a kind of new currency. And that kind of helps Libra in certain ways, but I think it also raises other problems that Facebook is going to have to answer before they actually try to launch this thing next year, which is what they're hoping to do.
So prices, if you want to buy something, will be expressed in Libra.
I think it's not entirely clear what the economy of Libra is going to look like once this thing launches. I mean, certainly Facebook has said, we want our marketplace, a Facebook marketplace, you can buy and sell goods using Libra. Will those things be priced in terms of dollars or will they be priced in terms of Libra? I think that's an open question. I think it's partially a question of, you know, how stable does Libra end up being? My guess would be on day one that things are still going to be priced in terms of dollars and you have to convert your Libra into dollars when you want to buy something. But I'm sure, you know, Facebook has big, big ambitions for this. They say they want this to be a new global currency, the sort of foundation for a whole new economy. And I think the long-term vision is that, you know, everything is priced in terms of Libra, but that's probably not where it is on day one.
The money-making machine of other forms of digital purchase is a fee that gets charged every time somebody buys something. But Angela Walsh, the plan is, as I understand it, that this is going to be nearly fee-free. There's going to be very little cost involved with using Libra. And so it's hard to understand what the business model is.
Yeah, I'm actually confused about that myself. I think that's one of the important questions to try to get an answer to as we're investigating this, as Congress is talking to people from Facebook about this in these upcoming hearings. How are they going to make money off of this? Facebook is, a company with a money-making mandate, right? It's supposed to make money for its shareholders. But yet there's a lot of language in the documents that they've released and their public comments about, we're doing this for the good of the world, right? We want to bring in people who have not previously had access to the financial system. We want it to be cheap And it's interesting because this these promises actually kind of echo a lot of the promises that were made early on with Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, right? That was said to be one of the amazing features of them, was that you could send money without cost, right? It was basically free for you to do it. So there was a lot of talk about remittances using Bitcoin, right? So people can send money back to their families in their home countries without paying the very high fees that they would with a Western Union or something like that. Well, interestingly, you know, we've kind of been coming to a gradual realization that transactions in these cryptocurrencies are not free. And the transaction fees on the network have fluctuated greatly depending on, you know, how many people were trying to use the network at any given time. So this is one I definitely have a big question mark in my head about. How can they be promising that these things will be free, right? Someone has to provide the infrastructure. Someone has to provide the validation, and those things aren't free. And that the companies involved in this are not nonprofits. They're for-profits.
Go ahead, Nathaniel.
There's an interesting precedent here, though, with Facebook itself, which is that when Facebook started, people said, how are you going to make money from people being friends with each other online? And Facebook sort of famously introduced this model that we're not going to worry about making money initially. We're just going to try to get lots of people using this thing, and then we're going to figure out how to make money from it. And Facebook has already said that's kind of their vision with Libra. We're not going to have an explicit business model on day one for how we're going to make money from this. They have laid out a couple of ways they might make money from it. But I think the vision here is, let's put something out there that's cheap, even perhaps even free, like Facebook was initially, and Facebook still is in some sense, and say, we're going to offer this free thing, get tons of people to use it, and then we'll figure out how that turns into a business. And so, you know, Facebook is not making money in some of the obvious ways on day one. They're not taking, you know, a transaction fee every time somebody sends a Libra around, or that's not the vision anyway. Their goal is, let's try to get as many people to use this as we can, and then we'll figure out how to make money from it. And that's a business model that Facebook has used successfully in the past.
Used successfully, but also gotten into tremendous trouble, no, Nathaniel?
Yes, for sure. And I mean, in some ways, this is the worst time that Facebook could introduce this. I mean, this is the moment when everybody has realized all of the problems with Facebook's existing business model. And so this is not a moment where everybody's going to say, oh, sure, you know, go ahead. You've taken over communications, you know, messaging, email. Yeah, let's welcome you to the financial system as well. All of the same questions that surround their existing model are now going to be directed at Libra, and are probably going to make it very hard to get off the ground.
Angela Walsh, earlier you talked about Facebook behaving like a sovereign, issuing money, which for the whole modern era has been the exclusive province of sovereigns. They're also acting like a bank, aren't they? And banks are one of the most heavily regulated industries on the planet, from country to country to country.
This is a... There's a lot of critique of the tech space because they... I guess there's a phenomenon that's sometimes referred to as tech solutionism. And that tech sees, you know, maybe some problems out there in the world. Maybe for one example here, maybe there's a problem with financial inclusion, right? And that money is not necessarily very easy to send around the world. And there's certainly doubt in existing institutions like banks and like governments. Absolutely. So many see this move by the tech sector, like Facebook, like probably others. Like, there's a lot of speculation that folks like Amazon or Google, like all of the big tech companies, are going to be moving more and more into the financial services space to compete with banks. And I think we just need to kind of, Nathaniel has talked about the history that these tech companies have had and the amount of scrutiny that they're facing now. And I think it's actually well deserved. So I think they should get that kind of scrutiny as they are coming to tread on ground that is highly regulated for a reason, right? Consumers are at risk when people take their money and manage their money. That's a justification for regulation. Systemic risk can be an issue. Financial stability, right? That's another big reason that we regulate banks and financial services. So I think tech has been historically very unregulated, but as they tread into these grounds of justifiably, I think, highly regulated areas, they need to expect to be subject to the same type of scrutiny and responsibility.
Well, one of the things any institution that was going to be a bank or like a bank had to do was meet certain reserve requirements to make sure that, you couldn't really be insolvent or running a pyramid scheme or something of the like. And it seems like if Mark Zuckerberg decides he's a banker, there has to be a little bit more, I don't know, rigor in this whole thing than just saying, well, you know, Facebook's highly capitalized and they've got a lot of cash, so therefore they can behave this way. And because the internet is not a someplace, it's an every place, sort of escape the kind of regulation that if I wanted to open a bank down the street from this studio where I'm sitting, would necessarily be part of the process. Angela Walsh, is this why, for instance, the chairman of the Federal Reserve has demanded that he has to be satisfied and take a look at some of the variables involved here before Libra goes ahead?
I think that's absolutely why that is. And I think it's a reasonable response, in fact, like a necessary response. And I'm hoping that the scrutiny from regulators, from policymakers will be very intense and will slow the process down. I think it's really important that we look at what activities are these people planning to engage in. Are they activities that we have historically regulated? Are they ones that banks have historically engaged in? Taking deposits, right? Loaning out funds, managing a reserve. If so, just because they're a tech company doesn't mean that they're not doing the exact same thing. So perhaps there should be the exact same types of regulations imposed on them. I think there's often this kind of veil that gets put over tech. You might call it a type of liability shield. And it's manifested in different ways from how Uber has been treated, right? Oh, we're not actually doing, we're not actually a taxi company. We're a platform for ride sharing. And I really hope that regulators look hard at just the activities. If they're the same, then we need to think of a really good justification for treating the party doing them differently.
Earlier, Nathaniel, you talked about why it's a bad time. Facebook has had tremendous scrutiny. Facebook has been called on the carpet very harshly in Europe, much the same in the United States, though perhaps with a less punitive result so far. Is that why it's moving ahead with Libra with 27 partners, including companies like Visa and MasterCard and Uber?
Yes, I think Facebook knows to some degree what they're up against here. They recognize the degree to which the tides have turned against them. And in designing this system, they have used a design that I think is aimed at addressing a lot of the criticism, at trying to make it so that this is a system that Facebook isn't in charge of, and that Facebook isn't the only one that has to answer for. And so that is why they have used this drawn on this Bitcoin design. You know, the idea with Bitcoin is that there's no single institution in charge. There's just this network of computers that's keeping the records around the world. And the interesting parts of Bitcoin are what make it possible for all of these computers to agree on who owns what money, even though there's no single authority. That's sort of the most novel and interesting part of Bitcoin. And Facebook has drawn on that and said, we are going to create this thing. You know, it started at Facebook, but we, Facebook, don't want to be in charge of this. We want to give the governance of this thing over to what's going to be a Swiss nonprofit that will initially, their goal is to have 100 companies that have sort of voting power over how this thing, what this thing looks like, what the design is. So far, they have 27 partners, including these big names, MasterCard, Visa, Uber, Lyft, Spotify. But the long-term goal, and Facebook has said this, is that actually anybody can sort of join in. It's what's known as permissionless. Anybody can join in and help maintain the network, somewhat like Bitcoin. But that design is you know, one of the many things that regulators are going to look at and say, you know, what happens when a terrorist starts sending money across the network? Who's in charge to stop that? Who do we go to when we see that, you know, Iran or North Korea is doing transactions on here and that's illegal? Who do we go to stop that? And so Facebook has created this design that is aimed at taking a lot of the pressure and the heat off of Facebook. But, you know, how they're going to do that in practice, I think, is going to be one of the trickiest bits. And at least so far, those other companies, all those partners, have not stepped up and said, you know, we think this is great and we want to answer for it too. They've said, you know, Facebook, you take the heat. Let's see if you can handle the heat. Let's see if we can get this thing actually going before we really attach ourselves to it too closely.
Angela, many people listening to this program, if they think back, the first time they even heard of Bitcoin might be when the Silk Road business was broken up, and a man who operated under the pseudonym Dread Pirate Roberts from the famed cult movie was selling heroin and cocaine and raw, untreated opioids and so on across the internet using Bitcoin. And the appeal was its anonymity, its difficulty of being traced, the distributed computing making it very hard to know where the money was originating and where it was ending up. How do you do this? How do you improve on it and not have it end up being a nest for criminals? How do you end up with a service that does all these wonderful things that Libra is proposing, helping the unbanked, helping people who have difficulty making transactions, don't have checkbooks, don't have bank accounts, and not have it become just another dark web way of criminals paying each other?
Well, there's a very interesting tension here that I think we're going to have the public debate about with Libra, but it's part of a public debate that is happening in the context of cryptocurrencies, as well as the explorations that central banks are doing about issuing their own central bank digital currencies. And it has to do with just this problem that you're talking about. How much privacy do we want people to have in their digital transactions? And how does any privacy that we give them in that realm, how does that enable crime, right? So the Silk Road is a good example of that. There was, of course, a lot of talk at the beginning of Bitcoin about it's anonymous, criminals can use it, and you can't figure it out. Since then, in the course of the past decade, we've discovered that that's not really true about Bitcoin, that it's actually not particularly anonymous at all, and that, if if law enforcement wants to invest the resources in figuring out who did which transaction, it's certainly not impossible to do. And so there's a big discussion in the cryptocurrency space that, you know, Bitcoin is not particularly private, but there are other new ones that are being developed that have the explicit goal of being fully private, such as Zcash and Monero. Okay, so this is all happening at the same time that Facebook is talking about Libra. And one of the big questions asked immediately was, how is Facebook and the Libra organization, right, how are they going to ensure, just as you asked here, that this is not just a criminal network? And they've assured policymakers so far in their comments, my read of their comments has been that, yep, we will expect to have the system align with the laws that, you know, financial institutions have to check that money laundering is not happening, that suspicious activity is not happening through their system. Of course, if they do that fully, that means that any digital transaction that you do through the system is fully traceable and everyone can see potentially, you know, who is doing what. And that makes me personally very nervous. I don't want every single bit of money that I spend to be fully tracked, but I also don't engage in crime. So there is not an easy answer to this question. And I think Libra is just going to bring it to the fore, this discussion.
We've been hearing from Angela Walsh and Nathaniel Popper about Libra, the blockchain cryptocurrency Facebook is launching in 2020. After the break, join us for the second half of the conversation moderated by Ray Suarez. You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. It is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. I'm Jane Wales, your host. We're hearing from Angela Walsh. She's a research fellow at the Center for Blockchain Technologies at University College London, and Nathaniel Popper, finance and technology writer for the New York Times. Moderating the program is my co-host, Ray Suarez. To hear this program or any other World Affairs program, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs. That's one word. And now back to our program.
Nathaniel Popper, is there a tension between ease of use and privacy? If you want to make a thing that's not as hard to use as Bitcoin, does that also make it harder to be private?
Well, this is I think going to be, you know, let's assume that regulators sign off on this. There's this sort of practical questions that are confronting this, which is, you know, how private is it? How anonymous is it? And how much does Facebook and the other operators of this network know everything that's going on? And either extreme is really problematic. You know, if every transaction that's done with Libra is private and everybody can have anonymity, then, you know, then some of the privacy concerns around Facebook recede. You know, Facebook doesn't know your financial transactions. That's probably something that makes people feel comfortable, but that comes with all these problems with criminals using the network. On the other hand, if if we try to protect against that criminal behavior by keeping the identity of everybody who's doing transactions on this network, and, you know, Facebook opens wallets and tracks all of your transactions, then, you know, you deal with some of the criminal concerns, law enforcement concerns, but then you have all these privacy concerns about Facebook being able to track your every move. And we're already worried about, you know, the way that Facebook handles your social networking data. You know, this is going to be another level if Facebook and the other companies that are running this network have your financial transaction data. And so, you know, either extreme is a problem. They're obviously aiming to find this middle ground where users have privacy, but law enforcement has access to the system, can come in and figure out if somebody's doing something illegal. The problem here is that if you kind of move to that middle ground, this begins to look a lot like the system we already have, which, you know, is aiming for that same balance. And that balance is, you know, what introduced costs into the system. It costs money to keep track of transactions and make sure criminals aren't using the system. And so then fees start to be added in, and it starts to become expensive. And then you get the question of why are we making this big change to go to a system that looks like a lot like the system we already have? So, you know, any of these, you know, the two extremes are a problem, but the middle is also a problem because it sort of raises the question of why are we doing this in the first place? We already have a system that sort of balances between privacy and sort of law enforcement needs. And, you know, this sort of starts to give you a flavor of the kind of practical issues that are going to face Facebook and Libra if this thing, gets an approval from regulators.
Angela Walsh, pursuant to that question, why are we doing this in the first place? If part of the answer is just to take banks and governments out of the mix, lessen the friction, make it easier, is part of the appeal that because the reputation of both governments and banks have been beaten down in the last 10 years or so, that this is attractive to people?
Yeah, why are we doing this in the first place? I think you've put your finger on really the core there is what's happening culturally right now is a massive loss of trust in governments and in institutions. And, you know, you think back to the financial crisis and the great loss of trust that happened in financial institutions and in the governments as well, because they didn't prevent it from happening. And with scandal after scandal coming out and inequality dramatically increasing over the last several decades, you know, there's a lot of resentment. There's a lot of anger with existing institutions. So, gosh, why would we let them keep running the monetary system and finance? All they're doing is, you know, siphoning money off of everybody, and it's not right. We can't trust them. So I think we're seeing different people stepping in to fill that trust vacuum. Kind of. In cryptocurrencies, there's very much a claim that you're not trusting any particular people. We're all in it together. And that is very attractive, right? If you can honestly feel that you're getting away from having to rely on another party for, you know, what value your resources are going to have, well, that's great. A lot of my work has focused on trying to poke holes in that and to illuminate who the players are that you're still reposing trust in. And Facebook, I think, is trying to step into that void here and say, trust us, which is, you know, kind of hilarious, as we've talked about a little bit here. But yeah, it's a trust vacuum. And my main concern here is making sure that as we are, you know, exploring these other options for where our trust should reside, that we're not just taking at face value statements that you're not trusting anyone. I've talked about there being a veil of decentralization in my work. And by that, I've meant that, you know, this mantra of decentralization is about breaking up concentrated repositories of power, right? And you feel like, well, if it's not in one place, then it's been spread out, so you don't have to worry about it. And in cryptocurrencies, I think there are very much power centers that you have to worry about, from the different validators on the network to the software developers that determine what goes into the code and promote what goes into the code. We need to apply the same type of scrutiny here to a Facebook and anyone who is purporting to step into to this role and say, you don't have to trust anybody.
If I could jump in, you know, Angela,
go ahead.
Sort of points out, I think, really useful sort of historical and ideological roots of this whole thing. But there is also a more sort of practical foundation that this is coming from, a practical problem that this is all growing out of. And that is the idea that the financial system and money really haven't kept up with the digitization of life elsewhere. You know, people in this digital financial world like to say that, you know, you can send a song or a document or an email across the world in 2 seconds, but if you want to send $100, it takes, you know, 5 days for all of the banks to communicate with each other and move money across the world. And the other piece of that is that there are, you know, depending on how you count it, 1 or 2 billion people in the world who don't really have digital financial accounts. You know, they have a smartphone and they have an email address and they might have a Netflix account, but they can't get a credit card or a debit card or a bank account. And so there is a real problem here with money. You know, a lot of the financial system does rely on relatively old, outmoded infrastructure that makes it very slow and creaky. And it does feel like there is a better way that money could move around, a different system, a different structure and network for money. And you know, Bitcoin and this and Facebook's Libra project are one manifestation of that. But even the central bankers and regulators who are criticizing, questioning Facebook are themselves working on systems to try to improve this, you know, and so you have central bankers themselves working on cryptocurrency projects to see if they can update their infrastructure. And so I think that's, you know, there are all of these questions that surround these new projects that are trying to fix these problems. But I think it's worth recognizing that there is a problem to be fixed. And I think that money is likely to change in the coming years. You know, it is likely to become more digitized. And what you have right now is this battle over what that's going to look like. Is it going to look like something that's more controlled by the tech companies? Is it going to look like something that's still controlled by the central banks? Or is it going to be some, you know, freestanding independent thing like Bitcoin or Ethereum that, you know, that a bunch of coders are in charge of? But I think there's a real battle going on here.
You're absolutely right. There are people with specific and particular needs that right now aren't being met by the existing system. But even with the number of people who are displaced, even with the huge number of people who send remittances across the planet, the lion's share of daily transactions worldwide don't cross borders, don't need a clearinghouse for currency exchange. If you're in Mombasa on the Indian Ocean coast of Kenya and you need to buy something in your daily life, it's likely going to be from a Kenyan in shillings. If you are in Johannesburg, and these are places where huge numbers of people don't have bank accounts, don't have ATM cards, don't have physical checks, but they're already leapfrogging in much the same way that the cell phone leapfrogged hard lines, they are using their phones to do daily transactions. Recently, when I was in China, I was the only person spending actual money. Everybody around me was paying for everything, literally everything, with their phones. One place I bought a coffee in the morning, didn't even quite know what to do with my money because I was the only person and this long line of people buying who was actually paying for my morning cup with money. Haven't they given themselves a steeper climb, a higher mountain to clear, by wanting to create a currency of their own rather than just a more efficient clearing system for making and receiving payments? Nathaniel?
The China example is a fascinating one. And in some ways, it's the thing that is the most worth understanding in this whole conversation. So as you point out, in China, the social network WeChat has created an internal currency, somewhat like PayPal. And then Alibaba, the main e-commerce site, has created its own currency called Alipay. And you've had the development in China where people didn't have credit cards, didn't have bank accounts. Suddenly, through their social network, they could have, through WeChat, they could have a digital financial account. And those digital financial accounts have become the dominant way that people pay for things in China. And so what you have is a social network and an e-commerce site that are increasingly running the financial system as well. And that's such an important thing to understand as you look at what Facebook is doing, what you look at what's happening elsewhere. One thing that's clear is that Facebook looks at WeChat and is incredibly jealous. You know, having WeChat's ability to control not just people's social interactions, but their financial interactions is incredibly valuable for WeChat. And so I think a big part of the way to understand Facebook's moves here is, you know, we want to look more like WeChat and, you know, have more parts of people's lives integrated into our network. But China...
But crucially, WeChat does its transactions in renminbi, in yuan, and it doesn't involve the dollars and euros and sterling and kwachas and rand or anything else. It's just renminbi.
Yes. WeChat's system looks a lot less revolutionary than Facebook's system. But in some ways, I mean, at this point, it is more revolutionary because it is where people's financial lives are lived in China. And WeChat is in charge of that system and knows every transaction that everybody's doing. And what's more, they've actually built financial services on top of this. They've started offering mutual funds and insurance and it's gotten risky. It's gotten very risky very fast because they didn't face the regulations that traditional banks did in China. And so if you look at China, you start to see exactly the sort of problems that we're talking about here. You can see that already happening in China. And Facebook's system, as you're pointing out, is even more sort of revolutionary than WeChat system because it does aim to be international, moving money across borders. But what we see in China is a sort of, pregame understanding. I don't know. It's a sort of trial run of what this looks like if the tech companies start to operate the financial system as well.
Angela Walsh, same question. Is Facebook, perhaps with, you know, a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, but giving itself a much tougher assignment by creating something that lives independently of currencies, of banks, and of national sovereignty, a borderless international currency?
I'm not sure I have a great answer for that. I think this is a much harder sell than just, I think they tried to do something with just Facebook credits, which would just be a purely internal tracking system for purchases within their system. Making it convertible, making the full-on connection with the financial system, I think, makes it much more significant. It raises the questions around competition with sovereign currencies that wouldn't as obviously exist otherwise. So maybe we should be grateful that they've put it on the table like this so that we can have a big conversation and flush out all these issues. One thing that I think perhaps needs to be rethought is in the materials that they've put out, they're talking about a launch date of early 2020, which is, gosh, about 6 months away. And for a product of this scale, a transition of this scale that impacts so many people in the world, I think we may need longer than 6 months to have this conversation.
Is it getting similar scrutiny, Nathaniel, in Europe?
The blowback from financial regulators around the world has been pretty remarkable. Basically, every major central bank in the world, an official at every major central bank, has said that that Facebook needs to slow down, has raised concerns and said that they're not going to feel comfortable with this until Facebook answers a lot of questions. Jerome Powell, the chairman of the Fed, is perhaps the highest ranking official to talk about this. And he has said he has serious concerns. And he said that there needs to there cannot be a race to implement this as Facebook had appeared to be pushing for, and talking about getting this thing out next year. Powell said we need to slow down and answer questions very slowly and very deliberately. And I mean, really, I think I've been struck by the fact that Facebook has not gotten much support from any corners of the government or regulatory world for this project. I was talking to Facebook before they launched this, and they said, we've talked to regulators, and they've been sort of neutral to positive on this. And that is not at all what the response has been since Facebook actually announced it. It's been almost uniformly sort of skeptical and negative. And I mean, it hints at the hurdles that Facebook is going to have to overcome before they can get this thing out into the world.
So, Angela, should we be looking at this almost on two tracks, one technical and one sort of legal?
Well, legal, political, I think. There's multiple tracks that you need to be looking at it on, right? There are technical hurdles that they have acknowledged, the scalability issues with permissionless systems like Bitcoin, right? Far fewer transactions can be processed per second than in our, other big systems like Visa and all of our existing payment systems. So Facebook has acknowledged that, and I think that's one of the reasons why they're going permissioned at the beginning, and they're hoping that there'll be some technical breakthroughs that enable them to, as they say, go from a more sort of decentralized model to a fully decentralized model. So that's one track. I think perhaps political and legal, I would put as maybe even bigger hurdles there. The lack of trust in them is just so high. So I think that may be, from my perspective, the highest hurdle that they have to get over. People might be willing to go along and say, okay, well, we'll just regulate this like we do other financial services, right? We'll figure out what activities you're doing, and we'll tailor the regulations to those. But with a Facebook involved, I'm not sure that people would trust that Facebook would follow those. I'm not sure. I mean, I'm very skeptical when I hear things said from David Marcus, who's the guy at Facebook, who's kind of the main communicator on all of this. When he says things like, well, Calibra, which will be their wallet, I guess, this is a separate subsidiary of Facebook. And so any financial data that they collect, we assure you that it will never get back to Facebook. And there have been so many promises broken by Facebook just in that exact domain about use of data. And we won't use this. We won't take it. There's boundaries there. The trust barriers are huge, I think.
So it sounds like even the partnership or standing at their shoulders of two of the largest transaction clearing mechanisms in the world, Visa and MasterCard, isn't enough to build in that trust. Mark Zuckerberg and co. have created a landscape, as you mentioned, of their own making, that it sounds like there's a lot to overcome.
From my perspective, there is. And also putting people like Uber on the list of validators. You know, Uber is not trusted widely either. And Facebook wears a big scarlet letter, I think. So I get why they would be involving all of these other companies and hoping to kind of remove some of their taint. But I don't know. It's a pretty strong taint.
Okay. So, Nathaniel Popper, you've got this ongoing trust problem, but you also have just the behemoth size capitalization of Facebook and its market penetration. One out of every four human beings on planet Earth has a Facebook account, if you believe the company. And it's that kind of bulk that gives people in places like, you know, Uganda or Mozambique or Tanzania, the willies, even as they need that service that Libra would provide.
Yeah, well, I think Facebook size is what gives them the best chance of succeeding here. I mean, on day one, they can offer this thing to, you know, somewhere between 1 and 2 billion people around the world. So they can offer them all Libra wallets. And that is something that no cryptocurrency project up till now has been able to offer. And that's been one of the biggest problems for cryptocurrencies is how do you get people to adopt this? How do you make it easy for them to hold it? And that's been one of the things that has held back cryptocurrencies. And that's one of the selling points of this one is that Facebook has that scale. They can distribute this on day one. But that scale is also what makes people so scared of Facebook operating this. And so they're not going to easily, get this out into the world. In places like, you know, Uganda, India, where this might be most useful, you know, where there are the most people who don't have financial accounts, a lot of those governments are already very skeptical of Facebook, have already put up barriers to Facebook services to date. And so, in some ways, the regulatory response in those places will be even more interesting because that might be where you'd expect it. This to be the most useful on day one. You know, in the United States, I think it's relatively easy to get a bank account, to get a digital financial account, you know, to use PayPal. In a lot of the developing world, that's where there are these difficulties in accessing the financial system where this might be more useful, but it's also where, the regulators might be most skeptical of Facebook.
Angela, I'm glad you amended my question, that it's not just legal, but political. An East African columnist writing for an East African website, Michael Kimani, said of Libra, what's really happening here is the American empire using Facebook and the Libra Coin Association as a proxy for controlling Africa as we transition into the digital economy and digital currencies. He goes on to say, this is a problem because Libra Coin is not backed by any African currencies or commodities. Instead, it's backed by a collection of low volatility assets, including bank deposits and government securities, in currencies from stable and reputable central banks. These include the US dollar or euro denominated sovereign bonds from the European Central Bank or the United States. So the very thing that's meant to give Libra stability, confidence, and heft, the fact that these are not volatile things that back it, is looked on with suspicion by an East African who sees the need among his own people in the wider column. He goes on to describe the needs for banking services among people all along East Africa, and yet he's terribly skeptical and very suspicious.
Yes, I saw that article, and I think it's excellent. It really made me think about things in a different way. I thought it was fascinating how he described the project as kind of like a new form of colonialism, almost, because it's no Africans involved. It's the people from the West, the big companies, and look who is currently on the proposed set of validators in the Libra Association. Right, they're going to figure everything out, and people in Africa just use this. We know how to solve your problems of the unbanked. And I found that article, Yeah, really illuminating. And I think it's an important part of the conversation that needs to happen. Our conversation today has been about regulators and in big countries, right? We've talked about China, we've talked about Europe, we've talked about the U.S., but we haven't talked much about places where there's lots of unbanked and where presumably much of the use of Libra would be targeted, right? So I think that's a very important strand to the conversation. So I'm hoping there'll be more of it.
Let's think about what a best-case scenario could look like if Facebook's aspirations can make it through the flaming hoops of regulators, of suspicion, of technical hurdles. What could be an outcome that would justify Facebook's great publicly expressed hopes for Libra?
Well, I guess it would be those hopes coming true, right? That more people would have access to digital financial services at a cost that is manageable to them, and that that could enable greater development and push societies forward, raise people's standards of living. That would be the best outcome.
Nathaniel Popper, final comment. Are the hurdles bigger than anybody even realizes? Are they proposing something that's so complicated that, first off, it's unlikely to happen by 2020, but also unlikely to happen even in the shape that it's being proposed right now?
I've been surprised by the degree of the blowback. I think Facebook was probably caught off guard by the degree of kind of skepticism and questions about this. And, you know, we've only touched on some of them here. You know, there are the legal and political hurdles. There are the technical hurdles. You have economists who deal with monetary policy who are looking at the design of the basket of currencies and saying, wait, I'm not really sure how that's going to work. You know, people have tried something like that in the past and it hasn't really worked. You have, you know, the tax implications. Is somebody going to, if their Libra, you know, are worth, you know, gain value between the time when they get them and they buy something, do they have to pay taxes on that? I mean, you don't have to worry about that with dollars. You know, those kinds of problems, there's so many of them, so many technical issues it's a lot. It's a lot. And I think there's a real question mark hanging over whether this is going to happen. But I do think it's worth sort of remembering how many people are in this race to try to sort of change money. And, you know, so now Facebook is one of the players in that race. But, you know, you have these Chinese tech giants, you have Bitcoin, you have the central banks of the world, you have JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs working on this stuff. So I think even if Facebook doesn't succeed here, I think something big is happening. You know, the sort of the ground is quaking under money, and it seems like something big is likely to happen. It's just not yet clear what it's going to be.
Nathaniel Popper of the New York Times, great to talk to you. Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
And Angela Walsh from St. Mary's University in San Antonio, Texas. Great to talk to you.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Angela Walsh, Research Fellow at the Center for Blockchain Technologies at University College London, and Nathaniel Popper, Finance and Technology Writer for the New York Times. This program was moderated by my co-host, Ray Suarez. On the next episode of World Affairs...
We fought communism and fascism and democracy was going to win because it was an ideology. We didn't have a word for oligarchy. We didn't know what it was to think about just pure power for power's sake.
World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our researcher is Claire McMahon. Our producers are Jared Sport and Ben Berliner. And our executive producer is Laura Beatty. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.